Good afternoon, everybody. Can you hear me all right? In the back, everywhere? Good. Welcome to Random Review. My name is Deborah Goldenberg, and along with Connie Georgiou, we coordinate this program for the Friends of the Library. This is the last Random Review of the season, and we'll start up again in September. Yesterday, the Random Review Committee, which consists of 12 people, met for 4 hours and deliberated, and we chose the books for the upcoming year. I can't reveal them yet, but they will be forthcoming as soon as we've confirmed all the reviewers and all the dates. So watch for the new season. It's going to be a good one. We have some wonderful books chosen. I'm really excited about it. I'd like to express gratitude to our sponsors who really helped us out this year, Trader Joe's for giving us their flowers, and Grassroots, who provides the books for our reviewers, Northwest Graphic Imaging, who makes the posters for each event, the beautiful posters that are out in our display case. Following Random Review today will be the annual meeting, open meeting of the Friends of the Library. It's in this room. It starts at 1:30, and being an open meeting, anyone can attend, and we'd love to see all or any of you here for that meeting. I'm sure it'll be fascinating. No, it's a good meeting and interesting to a lot of people. If you know anyone who wanted to come today and wasn't able to and missed this, we do make recordings of the talks and post them as podcasts on the library's website, so you have access to them in the comfort of your own home. I think that's about all the announcements for today. So I would like to invite Bonnie Brzozowski, who is an adult services librarian on the second floor in this library, who's going to introduce today's speaker. I'd like to invite her to come up and do that.
Can everyone hear me okay?
Yeah.
Great. It's my pleasure today to introduce today's reviewer, Kate McTavish. Kate McTavish is the perfect person to review Born to Run because she's a runner. But she's not just any runner, she's a freaking fantastic runner. She won first place in the 2010 Corvallis 5K race, first place in the 2011 Corvallis Half Marathon, second place in the 2012 Corvallis Half Marathon, and first place in the 2012 Eugene Half Marathon, just to name a few. And I'm winded even listing those. Go ahead and Google this champion runner, and you'll find she's run countless races and placed in many of them. Most recently, I found her name in the number one slot of the USA Track and Field Oregon 1 Mile Road Race in Portland this past May, where she placed first in the Women's 1 Mile Masters Run. She also promotes running among young girls through her activity in Girls on the Run, which is a nonprofit organization that is dedicated to using running to inspire, motivate, and build confidence in young girls, as well as encourage lifelong health and fitness as they train to run a 5K race. Kate is also an associate professor in the Human Development and Family Sciences here at Oregon State University. She researches how small towns and rural places function for the children and families who call them home. Specifically, she's published several studies examining the challenges faced by trailer park residents, and she's used this research to make policy recommendations to help address some of the challenges trailer park residents face today. She received a Bachelor of Arts degree in art education and a Master of Arts degree in early childhood special education from the University of New Mexico, and she also received her doctorate in philosophy from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Finally, and may I say most importantly, Kate is the mother of two beautiful daughters. Somehow she still manages to find time to be a phenomenal runner, and she even does a little gardening here and there. So please welcome Kate McTavish.
Else's big folder. Thank you, Bonnie. I don't know if all those first place finishes were totally accurate, but I'll take them. Quite often there's a little term in there that's the masters, meaning the first place finisher over 40 years of age, which qualifies you in running as a master's runner. Thanks for coming today. I appreciate having an audience and a chance to speak about something I am quite passionate about. I wanted to actually start off by taking us back a little bit in time and telling you the story about how I came by my first copy of Born to Run, because I think that'll be really important to understanding the way in which I experienced the book as I read it. So I hope the little intro tale doesn't get too long, but bear with me, there will be a connection. So that story starts back in the winter of 2009, which is actually the year the book was published. And my oldest daughter, who was 19 years old at that time, her name is Amanda, challenged me with an idea that winter. She said, "Why don't you run the Eugene Marathon, Mom?" She reminded me of how much running my first marathon in Chicago in 2000 had meant to me, which was now a decade earlier. How much it meant to me before I had a tenure track job and a new husband and another child who was born when I was 40 years of age. She said, "Remember how much you love training for that race." And then she said, "You should run another one. It would be something you could do just for you, Mom." And then she added, "And besides, I'm going to run the half marathon so we could kind of do it together." Of course, I bit. Who could forego the opportunity to do something with your college-age child, and particularly something that they were deeming as cool? I soon found myself opening a Nike Plus gadget on Christmas morning from that same daughter, downloading a training plan from Hal Higdon's website. He's a pretty famous coach. And this time it was an intermediate training plan, not the novice training plan I'd used for my first marathon. I also found myself falling in with a group of local runners, folks who, like me, spent Sunday mornings in what I have long termed the Church of LDR, the Church of Long Distance Running. And it was through this group that I came by my first copy of Born to Run, but not until after the marathon. Before I got the copy of the book, I first had to make my way through 4 months of training, logging some 800 miles in the Oregon rain, mostly on the streets of Corvallis. I had to endure my soleus, which is located in your calf, blowing up on what was the last 20-mile run of my training program. I had to toe the starting line on Agate Street, hobble through the last 6.2 miles of that race after my calf blew up again, feel the swell of emotions, and I might actually tear up again, but of stepping onto the track at legendary Hayward Field for the first time. And I had to do all that to remember something very important that would shape the way I read this book. I had always run over the years, but in recent years, my running had consisted mainly of errands, grocery shopping and other things, pushing a jogging stroller, or running on weekends a few miles out in the hills around Corvallis with my husband. But I'd forgotten how much I loved running and how much a love of running was really a visceral part of who I was. I crossed the finish line that day at the Eugene Marathon with a time a little bit slower than what I'd hoped for, but still 13 minutes faster than what I'd run 10 years prior. More importantly, I crossed that finish line once again a runner. I hobbled back to my daughter's dorm room and had a much-needed shower, and I would bet that I am probably the only parent who ever took a shower in one of the dorms at U of O. I spent an hour lying around on the couch in the lobby drinking chocolate milk to help me recover, but already my mind was working through the notion that I wanted to do this again. Much to my husband's initial dismay, that's just what I did. So we'd sort of had a deal that I could devote this time to training for another marathon, but that then after that was done, I could come back and we could have our normal life again. Little did he know. So I did it again and again and again. And now we just have marathon season at our house. And in that process, I rediscovered my inner runner self. And that launched me into what's been an amazing 3-year journey back into competitive running. But this time, as a master's runner. Fortunately, middle age had erased some of my memories of my earlier running times when I had been competitive in my 20-somethings, which is kind of nice because there's nothing like feeling like you've gotten slower. So I just couldn't really remember those times. And I started to revel in what I termed my post-40 PRs. For those last few years, I really feel blessed. And when we're done talking, I've got a couple images I can show you of just a few of those moments. Here I am with my older daughter with her medals after we finished that day. And this had to be one of the most exciting days of my life when I got to run at the USA Track and Field National Championships in the Masters Women's 3,000 meter race. And there's my mother with me, who came to watch me run all the way from New Mexico, and my younger daughter. And if you'll notice, her doll is even wearing a little track outfit. So, so the intergenerational thing is a piece of that. But having been a longtime track fan, getting to actually be on that track and compete was terribly exciting. We also had the chance to be interviewed by a reporter from the New York Times. So I got to appear in the New York Times as well. So my point in sort of reliving these experiences is that I really wanted you to understand the lens through which I came to reading of this book, because inevitably these kinds of experiences and the growing passion that I had reignited within me certainly shaped the way in which I approached the book. So I came by my first copy when I swapped Once a Runner, which was another book about running, for Born to Run, with one of my daughter's young male friends who I continue to train with these days. I'd been hearing about Born to Run for months, with folks often asking, have you read Born to Run? And suggesting, sometimes rather forcefully, you have to read it, you'll love it. In the end, I ended up owning 4 copies of the book, as folks generously regifted theirs to me after they'd finished it. But they were right, I did love the book. And in fact, I devoured it, reading it cover to cover. And I'm not typically a nonfiction reader. I'm very much more a fiction reader. But I was really eager for what this book had to offer, and I was hungry to find a book on running, or more accurately, a book about the love of running. In the end, what the book did was help me answer the question I often ask, why do I run? All right, now I'll just give a little summary of the book, and I'm going to read some segments out of the book that are illustrative, and hopefully make a point for how the book builds its case. The book begins with a slightly different question as McDougall, the author, goes in search of an answer to a question many runners often ask, why does my foot hurt? He has yet another running-related injury, and rounds of visits to physicians have not produced a satisfactory answer for him. Most, in short, have told him that perhaps he simply should stop running. Given his frame, he's well over 6 feet tall and not on the light side, they suggest that maybe running might not just be something that he was cut out for. Unhappy with this answer, McDougall, who situates himself within the book as something of a hero as he pursues this question, sets off on a journey to find the legendary Tarahumara tribe, a reclusive people in the Copper Canyon of Mexico, who are known as the running people. Tarahumara are reported to run distances many of us would not imagine, with the record being somewhere around 450 miles, or as McDougall points out, kind of the distance between New York and Detroit, right? All at one stretch. And they do this barefooted or wearing simple sandals. And as you can see, a kind of a loincloth drape, and often very brightly colored shirts as well. So you can hopefully make out there on his foot that he's got a real simple sandal attached to his foot by leather thong. What McDougall discovers as he researches the Tarahumara, he explains as follows. That was the real secret of the Tarahumara. They never forgot what it was like to love running. They remembered that running was mankind's first fine art, our original act of inspired creation. Way before we were scratching pictures on caves or beating rhythms on hollow trees, we were perfecting the art of combining our breath and mind and muscles into fluid self-propulsion over wild terrain. And when our ancestors finally did make their first cave paintings, what were the first designs? A downward slash, lightning bolts through the middle, through the bottom and middle. Behold, the running man. And there we have an illustration of that. He goes on, distance running was revered because it was indispensable. It was the way we survived and thrived and spread across the planet. You ran to eat and to avoid being eaten. You ran to find a mate and impress her, and with her you ran off to start a new life together. You had to love running, or you wouldn't live to love anything else. And like everything else we love, everything we sentimentally call our passions and desires, it's really an encoded ancestral necessity. We were born to run. We were born because we run. We're all running people, as the Tarahumara have always known. And that's really the premise of his book, that we are really born to run. We just need to remember how to do it. McDougall goes on to help the reader embrace these notions using three different strands within his book that he weaves together. The first of these is accomplished as he takes us to meet the legendary Tarahumara. His quest is to learn the secrets of these running people, secrets not easily accessed. And I'm going to now turn to read from the book. So he's just arriving down in Mexico with the hope of running into the Tarahumara. And what he's hearing from the first individual he speaks with is that it might be a little bit harder than he thought to actually access this community. Yes, you'd have to be down here for a long time before they'd feel comfortable with you. I was told later that night by Angel Nava Lopez, who ran the Tarahumara schoolhouse in Minuerachi. My Spanish is not quite what it might be. A few miles downriver from the Quemara's hut. Año y año, years and years, like Caballo Blanco. Wait, I interrupted. Who? The white horse, Angel explained, was a tall, thin, chalky white man who jabbered his own strange language and who emerged from the hills with no warning, just materializing on the trail and loping on into the settlement. He first appeared 10 years before. Shortly after lunch on a hot Sunday afternoon, the Tarahumara don't have a written language, let alone written records of weird human hominoid sightings, but Angel was dead certain of the day, year, and strangeness of the encounter, because he's the one who did the encountering. Angel had been outside at the time, scanning the canyon walls to keep an eye on his kids returning to school. His students slept over during the week, then scattered on Friday, climbing high into the mountains to their families' homes. On Sunday, they came traipsing back to school again. Angel liked to do the head count as they trekked in, which is why he happened to be out in the hot noon sun when two boys came tearing down the mountainside. The boys hit the river at full speed, churning as though they were being chased by demons, which they gasped at Angel when they made it to the schoolhouse, they probably were. They'd been out herding goats in the mountain, they said, when the weird creature darted through the trees above them. The creature had the shape of a man, but was taller than any human they'd ever seen. He was deathly pale and bony as a corpse and had shocks of flame-colored hair jutting out of his skull. It was also naked. For a giant, nude cadaver, the creature was pretty quick on its feet. It vanished into the brush before the boys could get more than a glimpse. Not that they hung around for more glimpsing. The two boys hightailed it back to the village, wondering who or what they'd just seen. As they reached Angel, though, they began to calm down and catch their breath, and they realized who it was. "It's the first chui I've ever seen," one of the boys said. "A ghost?" Angel said. "What makes you think it's a ghost?" By this point, several rarámuri, and that's what they call themselves, rather than the tarahumara, rarámuri elders were able to see had ambled up to see what was going on. The boys repeated their story, describing the creature's skeletal appearance, its wild shocks of hair, the way it ran along the trail above them. The elders heard the boys out, then set them straight. The canyon shadows could play tricks on anyone's mind, so it was no surprise the boys' imagination had run a little wild. Still, they shouldn't be allowed to panic, the younger children with such wild stories. "How many legs did it have?" the elders asked. "Two. Did it spit on you?" "No." "Well, there you have it. That was no ghost. That was just an arawara, the soul of the dead." Yes, that did make a lot more sense. So then they go on, McDougall goes on to sort of describe the dangers of the canyon and some of the beliefs about the Tarahumara people regarding the dead and how they will pass through the end of their life. But it's not long before Angel has the chance to actually have an encounter with this creature, even though he began to wonder whether that would actually ever happen. "Hola, amigos!" The mystery of the lone wanderer was solved even sooner than Angel had expected. He was still squinting into the sun, watching out for returning school children, when he heard an echoing yodel and spotted a naked guy waving and running down the hill toward the river. On closer inspection, the creature wasn't entirely naked. He wasn't exactly dressed either, certainly not in Tarahumara standards. For people who prefer not to be seen, the Tarahumara always looked fantastic. The men wore bright blouses, as you can see in the picture, over a long white cloth bound around the groin and left hanging, skirt-like in the front and rear. They cinch it all together with a rainbow-colored sash and accessorized with a matching headband. Tataramata women are even more magnificent, wearing brightly colored skirts and matching blouses, their lovely umber skin highlighted by coral-colored stone necklaces and bracelets. No matter what kind of fancy hiking duds you've got on, you're guaranteed to feel underdressed among the Tataramata. Even by sun-crazed prospector standards, the creature was seriously shabby. He only had on some dirt-colored chahochi shorts, a pair of sandals, an old baseball cap. That was it. No backpack, no shirt, and apparently no food, because as soon as he reached Angel, he asked in awkward Spanish for agua and made shoveling gestures toward his mouth. Maybe he should have something to eat. A sag, Angel told him in Tarahumara, gesturing for him to sit. Someone produced a cup of pinole, the Tarahumara corn gruel. The stranger slurped it down hungrily. Between gulps, he tried to communicate. He pumped his arms and let his tongue loll like a panting dog. Corriendo? The teacher asked. Are you running? The creature nodded. Todo dia, he said in his pigeon Spanish. All day. ¿Por qué? Angel said. ¿Y a dónde? Why? Where to? The creature launched into a long tale, which Angel found highly entertaining as performance art, but barely intelligible as narrative. From what Angel could make out, the lone wanderer was either totally nuts or not so lone after all. He claimed to have an even more mysterious sidekick, some kind of Apache warrior he called Ramon Chingon, Ray the expletive. ¿Y tú? Angel said. What's your name? Caballo Blanco, he said, the white horse. Pues bueno, the teacher said, and shrugged. Good enough. The white horse didn't linger. Once he'd gulped some water, a second cup of pinole, he waved goodbye and then trotted back up the trail. He stomped and shrieked like a wild stallion as he went, amusing the kids, who laughed and chased at his heels until he disappeared once again back into the wild. All right, let me see where I was. Okay. So that's our introduction to Caballo Blanco, who ends up functioning for Medulla as kind of a cultural liaison into the world of the Tarahumara. Caballo Blanco is also known as Micah True, although that name is not his given name either, but rather one he chose, I think, based on the name of a dog that he had. We learn a bit about how Caballo Blanco came to be a running guru and lived among the Tarahumara. And we hear also about how he provides an opportunity for McDougal to begin to understand some of the secrets of the Tarahumara with reference to how they can manage to run such long distances so consistently and without injury. So I'll switch to this. So this is Caballo Blanco talking about when he moved to the area. I decided I was going to find the best place in the world to run, and that was it. He told me as he walked back to the hotel that night. The first view made my jaw drop. I got all excited because I couldn't wait to get out on the trails. I was so overwhelmed. I didn't know where to begin, but it's wild out there. I had to give it some time. He had no choice anyway. The reason he was pacing at Leadville, we had earlier seen him as a pacer for the Tarahumara when they were competing in the Leadville race in the 1990s, and that's how he was introduced to the people and made his way down. The reason he was pacing instead of running himself was because his legs had begun betraying him after he turned 40. I used to have trouble with injuries, especially with my ankle tendons, Micah said. Over the years, he tried every remedy, wraps, massage, more expensive and supportive shoes, but nothing really helped. When he arrived at the Barrancas, he decided to chuck logic and trust that the Tarahumara knew what they were doing. He wasn't going to take the time to try figuring out their secrets. He'd just tackle it swimming hole style by leaping in and hoping for the best. He got rid of his running shoes and began wearing nothing but sandals. He started eating pinole for breakfast after learning how to cook it like oatmeal with a little water and honey, and carrying it dry with him in a hip bag during his rambles through the canyons. He took some vicious falls and sometimes barely made it back to his hut on his own 2 feet. But he just gritted his teeth, soaked his wounds in the icy water, and chalked it up to an investment. Suffering is humbling. It pays to know How you can get your butt kicked, Caballo said. I learned pretty fast. You'd better have respect for the Sierra Madre, because she'll chew you up and crap you out. By his third year, Caballo was tackling trails that were invisible to the non-Tarahumara eye. With butterflies in his stomach, he pushed himself over the lip of jagged descents that were longer, steeper, and more serpentine than any Black Diamond ski run. He slipped, scrambled, sprint downhill for miles, barely in control, relying on his canyon-honed reflexes, and is still awaiting the pop of a knee cartilage, the rip of a hamstring, or the fiery burn of a torn Achilles tendon. He knew were coming any second. But those injuries never came. He never got hurt. For a few years in the canyons, Caballo was stronger, healthier, and faster, or after a few years, than he'd ever been in his life. My whole approach to running has changed since I've been here, he told me. As a test, he tried running a trail through the mountains that takes 3 days on horseback. He did it in 7 hours. He's not sure how it all came together, what proportions of sandals or pinole or corima, but, hey, I interrupted him. Could you show me? Show you what? How to run like that. Okay. Meet me at sunup, he says. So it's the next day that they head out for the run. And in here we see Micah True or Caballo Blanco imparting some of his ideology on running to our author, McDougall. So McDougall is panting as he's being left behind. He says, I was trying to speak, but I kept turning into a pant horse. I finally got out, catching Caballo Blanco's ear just before he vanished around an uphill bend. He had set out in the hills behind Krell on a rocky pine needle trail, climbing through the woods. We'd been running for less than 10 minutes, and already I was dying for air. It's not that Caballo is too fast. It's just that he seems so light, as though he wills himself uphill by mind power instead of muscle. He turned and trotted back down. Okay, man, lesson one. Get right behind me. He started to jog more slowly this time, and I tried to copy everything he did. My arms floated until my hands were rib high. My stride chopped down to a pity-pat steps. My back straightened so much I could almost hear the vertebrae cracking. Don't fight the trail, Caballo called back over his shoulder. Take what it gives you. If you have a chance, because between one step and two between rocks, take three. Caballo had spent so many years navigating the trails, he'd even nicknamed the stones beneath his feet. Some were ayudantes, the helpers, which let you spring forward with power. Others were tricksters, which looked like ayudantes, but rolled treacherously at takeoff. And some were chingonositos, little bastards, just dying to lay you out. Lesson two, Caballo called. Think easy, light, smooth, and fast. You start with easy, because that's all you get. That's not so bad. Because if that's all you get, that's not so bad. Then work on light. Make it effortless. Like you don't give a show. Like you don't give a how high the hill is or how far you've got to go. When you've practiced that for so long, you can forget you're practicing. You work on making it smooth. You won't have to worry about the last one. You get those three and you'll be fast. I kept my eye on Caballo's sandaled feet, trying to duplicate his odd, sort of tiptoey steps. I had my head down so long I didn't notice at first that we'd left the forest. Wow, I exclaimed. The sun was just rising over the Sierras. Pine smoke scented the air, rising from dented stovepipes in the lodgepole shacks on the edge of town. In the distance, giant standing stones like Easter Island statues reared from the mesa floor, with sun-dusted mountains in the background. If I hadn't been sucking wind, I'd have been breathless. I told you, Micah gloated. So, nothing like having a beautiful place to run. So there were some of the lessons, some of the wisdom that was going to be imparted as a part of this book. So learning about that wisdom is something that McDougall is trying to impart, but he's also trying to use a clever device within this book, I would argue, where he introduces us to not only Caballo Blanco, who we can see is a fairly superhuman kind of character and a little bit quirky, but he introduces us to a crew of ultra-running folks who would fit within that category. And all at the same time that he inserts himself into the group. So I think what he's trying to do there is both make the case that these are extraordinary feats, but also allow us to see that he can hang in there. He can learn these lessons from Caballo Blanco, and he can begin to feel some of the power of this kind of running. So in other words, he's trying to help this to build his argument that all of us are born to run. So in that cast of characters, we really start to see what is often termed a Gonzo style of writing as he introduces these characters to us. He talks about legendary ultra runner Scott Jurek, who becomes one of the characters in this group. Others who have names like Barefoot Ted and the Young Guns, Tony Naked Guy Krupika, and someone named Dirt Diva, who is actually Katja Corbett, he tells us, once ran the entire length of the John Muir Trail, that's 211 miles in Yosemite, and then for fun turned around and ran it again. So again, he's impressing us with these kind of superhuman feats. We meet these folks through colorful asides to the main story that help us to see the nature of the individuals. And I'll just read a short segment about the Young Guns, who are Jen and Billy. Jen and Billy met in the summer of 2002 after Billy had finished his freshman year at Virginia Commonwealth University and returned home to lifeguard in Virginia Beach. One morning he arrived at a sand to discover that the luck of the bonehead had struck again. His new partner was a Corona commercial come to life, a beauty who earned top marks in all the bonehead scoring categories. She was a surfer, a secret bookworm, and a hardcore partier. Whose ancient Mitsubishi had a life-size silhouette of Gonzo rider Hunter S. Thompson aiming a .44 Magnum stenciled on the hood. But almost instantly, Jen began to bug him. She fixated on Billy's University of North Carolina ball cap and wouldn't let it go. "Dude," Jen said, "I need that lid." She'd gone to UNC for a year before dropping out and moving to San Francisco to write poetry. So if there was any karmic justice on this beach, then she should be sporting the Tar Heels gear, not some pretty boy surfer like him, who only wore it to keep the pretty boy bangs out of his eyes. "Fine," Billy said, "it's yours." "Sweet, if," Billy continued, "you run down the beach bare ass." Jen scoffed. "Dude, you are so on, right after work." Billy shook his head. "Nope, right now." Moments later, hoots and cheers rocked the boardwalk as Jen busted out of a porta potty, her lifeguard suit crumpled on the ground behind her. "Yeah, baby." She made it to the next stand a block away, turned around, and charged back toward the throngs of moms and kids she was supposed to be protecting from, among other things, full frontal nudity by college dropouts going wild. Amazingly, she didn't get canned, although that would come later when she shorted out the engine of the lifeguard captain's truck by sticking a live crab under the hood. So what these kids are situated within, McDougall argues, is as a place in which they're expected to accomplish nothing. So they're willing to try anything. And audacity beckons, he says. So Billy then later asks Jen, "Have you ever heard of mountain masochists?" "Nope, who's he?" "It's a race, you crackhead, 50 miles in the mountains. Neither of them had ever run a marathon before. They'd been beach kids all their lives. So they'd barely seen mountains, let alone run them. They wouldn't even be able to train properly. The tallest thing in Virginia Beach was a sand dune. 50 miles was way over their head." "Dude, that's totally it," Jen said. "I'm in." And then we hear him recount the adventure of their run, where Jen in, this is the Old Dominion 100 that they're racing in a few months later, comes through the halfway mark in the first aid station with her fist pumping in the air as she's saying, "That's all you got, Old Dominion? That's all you're going to give me?" You know, she's very cocky. Billy arrives with her at the aid station with her favorite mid-race meal, which is Mountain Dew and cheese pizza, which she manages to gobble down before she heads out. The people at the aid station express a little bit of concern because she is currently on pace to be running 3 hours under what had been the former record there, and they think she might need to slow down a little. Keep in mind, this is her first ultramarathon, and she has not run a marathon, period. So Billy shrugs. He knows after a year with Jen that she's capable of absolutely anything except for moderation. So she continues full speed ahead until she hits the wall. And then that she hits that wall with a vengeance, he says, at the 75-mile mark. It's now 6 in the evening, and the entire arc of the sun has passed since Jen has started running at 5 in the morning, and she still has a marathon to go. So we begin to doubt whether she can do it. Billy jumps in to run that last section of the race with her, which is a pretty common thing to have happen in both marathoning and ultra running. It takes her a little bit, but she does manage to come back from that wall that she hit and ends up finishing. At 10:30 that night, Jen and Billy had passed every other runner in the woods except one. Jen didn't just finish. She was the second runner overall and the fastest woman to ever run the course, breaking the old record by 3 hours. To this day, her 17-hour, 34-minute record still stands. When the national rankings came out a few months later, Jen discovered she was one of the top 300-mile runners in the United States. Soon, she'd set a world best. Her 14-hour, 57-minute at Rocky Raccoon 100 was and remains the fastest 100 miles on dirt trail ever recorded by any woman anywhere. So again, superhuman characters that we've got going. So what ends up happening is that McDougal ends up assisting Caballo Blanco in arranging what is termed in the subheading of the book as the greatest race the world has never seen. So they pull together a collection of these runners like Jen and Billy, world premier ultra runners, and bring them to the Copper Canyon to run with the Tarahumara. And I'm not going to spoil it by telling you too much about how the race turns out, but it ends up being a wonderful, wonderfully interesting story with a lot of rich cross-cultural exchange happening, and of course a lot of adventure as well. And McDougal himself participates in the race. So again, that's that reinforcing the notion that we can all do this by having someone who's much more grounded on earth take part in that. Right. So that was sort of the first strand. Then he employs a second strand as he builds his argument that we're born to run. And in that second strand, really what he's trying to do is help us to understand how we might have forgotten that fact. So in that, he constructs a diatribe really against the billion-dollar shoe industry, namely blaming Nike, and he pulls Bill Bowerman into that account too, making the case that they sold us out by promoting thick-soled, gel-filled shoes that McDougal blames for actually contributing to more injuries than the prevention of those injuries. I've got a picture of one of those shoes. This is called the Brooks Beast. And as you can see, that sole has a lot to it. These injuries and even the notion that we need something to protect us from running, he asserts, adds to our forgetting that we were born to run. So I'd ask you all as the audience, how many of you have ever been warned that running might be bad for you? Anybody? I see some hands. What did people say?
You're going to ruin your knees and regret it when you get older.
You're going to ruin your knees and you're going to regret it when you get older. Okay. Other admonitions or warnings? Back in the corner.
You just don't have the body for running, and that was my doctor who was a triathlete.
Yeah. And that's what McDougal had heard from his doctor. Okay. You just don't have the body. There's a body type. It might be for some people, but it's certainly not for all of us. Okay. Any other warnings? My father, who's had double knee replacement, loves to remind me of the knee one, right? So sometimes we're also told that we should moderate if we are going to run, right? Don't run excessive amounts. Avoid the pavement. And by God, if you're going to run those kind of miles, make sure you have the kind of shoes that would protect you. So McDougal, in his assertion that somehow this whole push towards having something to protect us has led us astray, illustrates this by asserting three painful truths. The first of these truths is that the best shoes are actually the worst. And he has research to back this up. So a study in Switzerland compared a group of runners who'd all competed in the same competition and looked at those who had more expensive shoes and those who were wearing cheaper shoes and collected a great deal of information about how people trained and ran and what their times were, et cetera. And he actually found that those who were wearing the top of the line shoes, those shoes that cost over $100, were 123 times more likely to be injured than those wearing cheap shoes. So there we often think, well, if we just buy the most expensive shoes, will be protected. His second painful truth is that feet like a good beating. The more cushioned the shoe is, the less protection it actually provides. And some of the science behind this one actually comes from the scientists at the University of Oregon, who compared what happens when people run in old shoes, shoes that they've been wearing for quite a while that are squished down, compared to running in new shoes with that fresh gel and fresh padding in them. What they found was that essentially we adjust to what we have underfoot. Less cushioning, we compensate by landing more lightly on our feet. More cushioning, we actually push down harder in order to seek stability for what's underneath us. And you might think about that if you're running across something hard in your bare feet versus running across something that's much more spongy or squishy. Maybe one of the best illustrations would be thinking about those gymnasts when they land on those very thick pads and they're really trying to stick it, how hard they actually hit on that squishy surface. For the third painful truth, he brings Alan Webb into the picture. And Alan says, and if you don't know who Alan Webb is, you will in a moment, that humans were designed to run without shoes. And Alan's not alone in that. So before Alan Webb became America's greatest miler, he was a flat-footed frosh with awful form. But his high school coach saw potential and began rebuilding Alan from, no exaggeration, the ground up. Alan says, I had injury problems early on, and it was because apparently that my biomechanics could cause injury. And it became apparent that my biomechanics could cause injury, Webb told me. So we did foot strengthening drills and special walks in bare feet. Bit by bit, Webb watched as his feet transformed before his eyes. I was a size 12 and flat-footed, and now I'm a 9 or 10. As the muscles in my feet got stronger, my arch got higher. Because of the barefoot drills, Webb says, also cut down on his injuries, allowing him to handle the kind of heavy training that would lead to the U.S. record for the mile and the fastest 1,500-meter time in the world for the year 2007. Barefoot running has been one of my training philosophies for years, said Jared Hartman, a physical therapist, the Irish physical therapist who serves as the great and powerful Oz for the world's finest distance runners. Paula Radcliffe never runs a marathon without seeing Hartman first. The titans like Haile Gebrselassie and Kalib Konochi have trusted their feet in his hands for decades. For decades, Hartman has been watching the explosion of orthotics and even more structured running shoes with dismay. The deconditioned musculature of the foot is the greatest issue leading to injury, and we've allowed our feet to become badly deconditioned over the past 25 years, Hartman says. Pronation has become this very bad word, but it's just the natural movement of the foot. The foot is supposed to pronate. So some people feel like McDougall's indictment of the running shoe industry is a little overdrawn. He does make, in the book, shoe companies out to be quite the villain with Nike on that list. I found it to be quite accurate, although I would confess I have always been a fan of more minimalist footwear and miss those days when we had those old Oregon waffle trainers that were a product of Bowerman that really had not much to them other than that little bit of rubber. I do find it a bit ironic, though, that McDougall's argument no doubt played into or played no small role in the new market of shoes. And it's not hard to discover that market as you begin to look on, say, Roadrunner Sports website, where you can choose between minimalist, barefoot, or caveman-style running shoes. So the running companies caught up quite quickly to rediscover the capitalist side of the minimalist argument. McDougall also uses a third strand to reinforce the notion that we're all born to run. And again, he brings science to bear in support of his argument. Science that supports the notion that humans were actually built from their skull to their Achilles tendons for running far. Notion that humans could actually run an animal to death is something termed persistence hunting. I'm not going to go into much detail here, but I will say that section of the book really provides some compelling logic and some pretty strong science to back that up. So those are sort of the three ways in which he tries to convince us that we are all born to run. I want to close my review with emphasizing some of the takeaways for me as a runner from this book. And the first of those is that while you might overextend the blame for our injuries to running shoe companies, as I said, I've been a long believer in minimalist shoes, and I really think the value in some of his argument is that he calls on us, all of us, to pay more attention to our running form in those simple lessons that we heard him repeat there about remembering to go easy, light, Caballo Blanco sharing those. And also he provides another idea from one of his running teachers, that we could just imagine what it would be like if our child were to head off into the street and we found it necessary to run after them barefoot. What kind of stride would we take in that running? How naturally that comes to us and how we might think about that. So paying attention to form, I think, is one of the important takeaways for me. There's also good messages about diet. And I have to say that when I read the book, I did run out and get some chia seeds. I actually brought them. I did bring a pack of chia seeds because I was curious about these. He was toting these as one of the foods that the Tarahumara used within their diet that had, he thought, some special powers to them, one of those great omega-3 kinds of things. All right, so I'm still working through that first bag. This is the second bag I've ever purchased. That first one I bought at Stoker's Vita World, so it took a little bit of an investment of time in order to obtain, if you all have shopped there. I noticed that they are now stocking these at the shelves of Trader Joe's, so I would say that some of his lessons there for us have been adapted into wider acceptability if they're so readily available. He also puts forth an argument that we should think about a vegetarian diet as being something more helpful, and we've certainly seen a lot of publication around that more recently. So another kernel of good advice on his part. Then McDougall also has a clever way, I say, another takeaway from me, of making us all believe that we can join the tribe. He urges us to return to this, the most natural of sports pursuits. Surely a notion that should gather wide support when we think about the current obesity and health conditions that we have in the United States today. In that urge to join the tribe, he reminds us that running is not about losing weight alone, though. Not about having a tighter butt, or collecting what is often termed SMOs, shiny metal objects. It's about more zen-like aspects. And here I'll return to let Jen sort of reveal a different side of herself in a brief statement about what running means to her. So he asked Jen about running, and here's what she said. I never really discussed this with anyone because it sounds pretentious. But I started running ultras to become a better person, Jen told me. I thought if you could run 100 miles, you'd be in this Zen state. You'd be like the Buddha, bringing peace and a smile to the world. It didn't work in my case. I'm the same old punk ass as before. But there's always that hope that it will turn you into a person you want to be, a better, more peaceful person. She goes on to say, hey, when I'm out on a long run, the only thing in life that matters is finishing the run. For once, my brain isn't going blah, 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 blah all the time. Everything gets quiet. And the only thing going on is pure flow. It's just me and the movement and the motion. That's what I love. Just being a barbarian running through the woods. He also reminds us that running just isn't about us alone, but it's about camaraderie. He says, we weren't just born to run, but we were born to run together. So an important piece of those things as the group. I have a couple of follow-ups I wanted to offer too that made rereading the book a little bit interesting this time. A little over a year ago, Caballo Blanco actually died. I don't know if you all remember seeing that in the news. It was covered in the New York Times. He was out for a run. And which is exactly the way he said he wanted to die, in the Gila Wilderness in New Mexico. I happened to be back home at the time, so my hometown is not far from the Gila Wilderness, so it was particularly touching because it intersected with my location there. And I had the headlines from the New York Times, but I forgot that on my desk. Also, recently I ran across an article in Outside Magazine on this persistence hunting that described a group of marathoners who train in Albuquerque and Santa Fe, New Mexico, who decided to put this to the test and see whether or not they could actually run down a pronghorn antelope. So they paid the $900-something to get a permit to kill an antelope, and they headed out onto a ranch where they were, where hunting was allowed. They actually had to learn how to shoot a gun just in case they really did catch the antelope. And they proceeded to spend the day trying to work together as a group to run down an antelope, and got probably closer than they wanted to get. And then in the end kind of called it a day, and didn't have the heart to actually shoot the animal in the end as well. But they did add another bit of evidence to perhaps the notion that this idea that we were built to run or born to run long distances might have some validity. And then I thought I would just close by putting on a little slideshow of my most recent running adventures, which was in celebration of my 50th birthday, which was back in January, and one of my training partner's 30th birthdays, which happened in March. And we decided to head to the Grand Canyon and start on the North Rim and come out on the South Rim. That was enough for us. I know many people do more crossings than that, but it was an amazing experience. And an amazing thing to share this with someone else too. So I'll put those images on and maybe we can watch them scroll through and then we can start with some questions. So this was my first ultra run. And it only qualified because it might be just a tad, a tenth of a mile longer than a marathon, the route we took. So you start on the North Rim at about 8,000 feet and then make your way down to about 2,400 feet by the time you hit the Colorado River and come back up. Now it's getting warmer, so taking a layer off. So this is along the Bright Angel Creek, and there were locust trees blooming down there that smelled better than anything I've ever smelled. Yeah. So we started at 5 in the morning, and then in order to be finished before it got really hot. This was the weekend before Memorial Day. And there's the Colorado. This was my first time to the bottom of the Grand Canyon. And we weren't alone. This was one of those windows that there's about a 2-week window of opportunity in the spring and one in the fall when people can do this before it gets terribly, terribly hot at the bottom. So there was actually a lot of conversation among the rangers about how do we begin to control these these nuts that come out here and do these rim-to-rim or rim-to-rim-to-rim runs. And just the Friday before we got there, someone had set a brand new record for the fastest known time.
Did your friend take the pictures?
She did. So she, I would have to say she was much better about
taking
pictures than I was. So now we're going up. You can see I'm getting a little slower. Finally, when I got up to the point where I saw some cigarette butts on the trail and toddlers, I got a second wind, and it was more encouraging.
But you're not barefoot.
I was not barefoot, no. But I am running in what are called Newton brand shoes, and they have a zero cant, so they put the padding under your forefoot instead of your heel. And I don't know. So that was another way I got sucked in reading the book, thinking about switching my stride and my shoes. And they claimed that you'd have an instant PR, personal record, when you ran in them. And I don't know if it was the shoes.
PR.
Personal record.
Have you ever run barefoot?
I have. I actually trained barefoot when I was a teenager in Florida. One summer, my younger brother and I decided we'd spend the summer training barefoot. And there were mostly brick roads, so it was really a little different feel than what you get, or running in the dirt. But having been a ballerina early in my life, I really do feel like I have lost a lot of strength in my feet, and they have continued to get bigger. I don't know if that's just age or anybody else have questions?
Ben, you should write your own memoir. I think it'll be interesting.
I've been bumping into a lot of women about my age who got back into running when they got a little bit older.
Did you see any condors?
No, my husband did, but I was about 5 feet from a mountain goat at one point. And he came around the corner, and I was going, and he took one look at us and went back around the corner, and then all we saw was a puff of smoke when we got there. narrow dust. We couldn't find him anywhere. I think he was probably right above us hiding. But
amazing area.
Did the book mention that most of these people live in caves?
It did.
And did it mention the wonderful baskets that the women make?
He did not talk about the baskets
in
the book.
Oh, fantastic.
But you have some pictures, right?
Well, I have some baskets.
Oh, okay. Someone brought pictures. So do you have baskets in your pictures?
I should have brought the baskets.
Yeah.
I think orange.
So was this all one way, or did
yeah, we ran one way, and then our crew had to drive around and pick us up.
How long did it
Good.
Take you?
6 hours.
Wow.
How many?
Six hours.
Did you take with you all sides?
We took mainly. I think we each had two Clif bars and a couple of gels, and you really have to hit the salty stuff, which was a surprise to us. So we actually went out and bought some nasty food that we would normally never eat, combos with the cheese inside them, those pretzel things, and the peanut butter and crackers that are heavily sprinkled with salt. And we were really glad that we got that advice the day before we started to ramp up the salt. That was the most important thing, besides the water. And actually there were six different places where we could stop and get water, six or seven, so it was pretty doable. I will say, our national park, the Grand Canyon, is in really sweet shape now compared to what it was when I visited in the late 70s. And the El Tovar was beginning to fall apart.
Was the air quality pretty good? Because when I've been there, you could barely see across the canyon.
Yeah, we were lucky. It was very, you could see the smog out in the distance, but it was the visibility was absolutely wonderful.
I'm fascinated by this idea of foot strengthening. That I don't normally remember, but you brought back to me that when I was a kid, I'd go barefoot
all the time. Long, yeah.
And then have to squeeze my feet into the shoes to go back to school.
And they hurt.
Yeah. But now I never go barefoot, and it's very unpleasant. So what does the foot strengthening, how's it done? How do you go about it?
One way is that you can use a stretchy band or a towel, and you just simply put that on the floor, and then you have your bare feet, and you crinkle that up with your toes. So I often do that at work while I'm working. It's something you can easily do on your desk. As a dancer, we used to do lots of things like pick up marbles and pick up pennies and drop them into containers. I at one point could actually tie a bow on a shoe with my toes. So just working with your feet on that dexterity. There are, of course, gadgets you can buy.
So. Oh, I'm sure.
Is it true that the Tarahumara are no longer invited to run in the Lead Hill 100?
He doesn't cover that, and I would have to plead ignorance.
I read that maybe in the last year or so that they're no longer.
That was one of the sadder parts of the book, was how they were really taken advantage of by some of the people who were promoting their coming to, and weren't, you know, instead of coming home with what they should have received, they got some corn and didn't know that they were being ripped off and mishandled.
I'm just curious, have you ever read about running and kicking the wood?
Yeah, they did talk about that as part of that foot strengthening training to get your stride and your agility.
Yeah, I did.
I think one of the neat comments in the Leadville run, when the Tarahumara were running, I think it was the first or second year, and they were so far ahead of everybody else, and they kind of, the two that were in the lead, kind of came in together, and the people who were watching said what impressed them was they were laughing.
They were laughing, and that was one thing he brings up, is sort of that love of running peace and that smiling, grinning that so often characterizes what people see when they look at really excellent runners. Somehow we have to remember that. So that's another point he emphasizes on the floor. It's not all about hurt and pain. Well, thank you all.
Yeah, thank you.